Hi, I'm Kylie.
And I'm Elliot.
We're hosts of Bad Dad, Rad Dad, a Snack Labs podcast where we look for better dads one movie at a time. Every week, we talk about the movies we watched, the thoughts and feelings they brought up in us, and the best and worst dads we found in them.
Our weekly movie picks can span decades, genres, languages, and more. Plus, we keep it totally spoiler-free so you can discover movies that you want to watch.
So join us every Thursday on our silly little movie journey to hear about the movies we watched that week.
And the dads they made us wish we had. Because
my dad's dead.
And my dad's a deadbeat.
But as far as we're concerned,
not all dads have to be bad.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, baby.
Hello, my love.
Here we are, back in the same room together.
Back in the saddle.
Back in the saddle.
Yeah, it's nice.
Lockdown's kind of easing up a little bit. So the two of us are here in the same studio. The studio is not set up for two of us.
If you're a $5 patron or up, you can hop on over to patreon.com/turnmeon and look at how strange it is that Jeremy and I are in the same room recording this lovely episode together. And I'm sitting basically directly behind him and off to the left.
Yep, that's it.
Facing the back of his head.
That is it.
That's the COVID way.
That is the way. This is the way.
I just lost sound in my headphones. You didn't lose me though, did you?
I didn't.
Okay, great.
Do you want to fix that?
No, it's okay. It came back.
Oh, okay.
Oh, now it's gone.
All right.
I'll just pop it off my ear so I can hear you.
Here, let's fix that.
It went in and out. Oh, it's back.
Is it?
It's back.
Okay, there we go. All right.
You're going to give me a round of applause?
No, I was going to. Anyway, folks, thanks for tuning in this week. We are very excited for this week's guest.
Yeah.
Kat Nance. Man, what a fucking sweet, sweet conversation that we had. I'm very excited for it.
Some really interesting stuff that I think we've only briefly touched on in other worlds and in other ways, but just listening back to this conversation just prior to this today, there were so many things I just wrote down just to remember. It's nice when you talk to someone who, I mean, this is Kat's work, but when you talk to someone who's so grounded in what they're talking about that they just have a way of describing it essentially that is unlike anything you've ever heard before.
And we will get into that conversation, but Kat Nance is a somatic pleasure and relationship coach. Mm-hmm. And we dive deep into the work of somatics. And is that how you would say it? Somatics?
I guess so. We really, I feel like when I listened back and I heard Kat describe like basically her title, and then knowing where it went, I was like, wow, we really grabbed the wheel on that and took it to like trauma town.
We sure did. Yeah. I mean, full disclosure. I like broke down in the middle of the recording. I cut that part out. It was a little too personal, but I had a full meltdown. It was very, you know, it hit really close to home.
That's it. That's it. When I think that's what I'm trying to get at. It's like when someone speaks to you about something that like it pierces into you, you go, this is true. And I feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite interesting. Very excited to throw to that conversation. But before we do, we're going to talk about some fun stuff. Let's start off with this actually, Bridie. I didn't tell you about this. This is very, I thought this would be very entertaining. This is from the New York Post. Emergency crew rescues sex doll after mistaking it for a drowning woman. This took place in Japan.
Oh, I love it.
The New York Post goes on to say here, they issued an SOS, save our sex doll. Look out. They're here all week, folks. A team of emergency rescue divers was flummoxed after responding to the scene of a nude drowning woman, only to discover that it was actually a floating life-size sex doll. This is the image that a woman, a YouTuber, Natsuki Tanaka, came across. She chronicled the whole thing via Twitter. She witnessed this floating. Now that's, I mean, look, folks, if you want to see what we're looking at, you could either Google the New York Post ad article, or you could follow us on Patreon. But if you saw that floating in the wood,
I will 100%. That looks like a fucking deceased corpse. Floating corpse.
Yeah, it's gnarly.
Wait, I can't tell from this distance. Is the doll wearing any clothes?
It doesn't look like it. Actually, it does look like it has
maybe a top.
Yeah, it has like a, looks like a, maybe a,
a bandeau.
I don't know what that is, but some pink underwear and like a pink sort of nighty top.
Okay.
So while filming a fishing video, I thought a dead body was floating in the water and had washed up, but it was a blow-up doll. Tanaka wrote about the strange scene which occurred last week. This happened in Hachinohe off of the coast of Japan's northeast coast, on Japan's northeast coast. Sorry. She added that someone else had mistakenly phoned the authorities over the drowning woman, which prompted a Blues Brothers-esque army of emergency services to arrive, ready to rescue what they thought was a person in peril. And
tell me there's a photo of them posing with the sex doll.
This is a photo of them pulling the doll.
Whoa, that's so, looks so gnarly.
It does look so gnarly. It's a pull. So for listeners only, it's this like rescuer hoisting this soaking wet and probably super heavy sex doll out of the harbor. And it's very clear in this photo that it is not a human woman.
Yeah.
But a sex doll. Thankfully, the adult toy was rescued safely, according to Tanaka. But it's unclear how the blow-up doll ended up in the water. Perhaps,
well, see, that's what's going to fuck with me. It's like seeing a weird one shoe in the middle of the road.
Yeah. Like one baby shoe. You're like, whoa.
What's the story here?
Yeah, what's going on? we talked about this on Sick Boy for this coming Friday's episode. And we were like, Brian was convinced that like it was, like, you know, a seaman was just tired of his like mate on the sea and toss it off to the side. But according to the New York Post here, one Twitter user who also documented the bizarre rescue chalked up the incident to illegal dumping of oversized trash, which is unsurprising given Japan's stringent laws concerning garbage disposal. So could be that. I mean, I don't know.
That's really interesting. So
that makes sense to me that it was like in a garbage heap and someone just unknowingly dumped it. You know, there's so much fucking shit in harbors.
Yeah, that's true. I was kind of picturing like, okay, there's like a bachelor party on a yacht someone brings it. That I was thinking that, but then
someone
I remembered
fucked it off the boat.
But then I remembered Yuri Tolochko from Kazakhstan. Do you remember him?
No, what's that?
Yuri Tolochko from Kazakhstan married his silicone love, Margot, in November 2020.
Right.
But somehow, just before Christmas, she had to go to a sex doll doctor to be repaired. And I believe that that one of his 99,000 followers asked him if he was cheating on his wife because he had another doll who he ended up getting pretty close to. And I think he and his original doll did end up getting a divorce because he fell in love with another.
You don't say.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Tolochko has previously claimed Margot had a waitressing job at a local bar.
This is very interesting because I feel like Mr. What's his name?
Tolochko.
Tolochko.
Maybe something dark is afoot.
You know what I really fucking love about that story is that. So. And then, look, we've talked at length on this show about the use of like real life sex dolls and how they do really like play an important role in some people's lives. And like, I think they're fucking way. I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome that exists and that you can get a doll, the quality of just like mind blowing quality.
Yeah.
I think it's all great. There's something so interesting about that story about that guy from Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
In that, like, he's so committed to the role play,
mm-hmm.
you know, because like if he wanted to, he could be like, I'm a sheik with like concubines. I have all the women I want. But that's not what floats his boat. He likes the like you know this notion of like I am committed to this one particular woman and yeah. but that oh no I'm now attracted to this maybe this younger model no pun intended there and so now he's like you know he's facing the woes the woes of that humans face when you know struck with wandering eyes and adultery and those things. And I love that. I love that. I'm assuming that's what's happening here.
I should get him on the show.
Yeah.
I wonder if I get him on the show. Cause like there is a level of, like you said, commitment. To the role play that is, you know, I'd already read all of this, but I it's so interesting. So he married his partner and then after because he's like a kind of a well-known bodybuilder. And after he posted his wedding photos, he said, when I presented her photo to the world, there was a lot of criticism and she began to develop a complex. So we decided to get plastic surgery. So he took her to like a human plastic surgery place and they did some work on her. And yeah, it's,
I don't think we covered this on the show.
Oh no,
this is news to me. Yeah. Yeah. This is foreign to me.
Okay.
I have a bad memory, but I think I would have remembered that.
All right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That, I mean, it would be neat to speak him just to get a sense of
how does it work?
Yeah. How does it work?
Did you watch, I've talked about it on the show. It was a newish Amazon series that just came out about the guy who's trying to like trying to merge brains with his partner. And it's like it's a comedy.
Oh no, I haven't. I haven't heard of that or seen that.
God, someone's out there listening, screaming the name of the show. Anyway, the woman in it, her dad, Ray Romano, played by Ray Romano, has his wife is a sex doll, and he goes, and he's known in the town as like the weird pervert, but right. like he takes her on dates and they go and they have dinner and he's like, I don't give a fuck with what the town thinks, like fuck all these people. Yeah, it's a really interesting and actually really like sweet part of the show. There's something very wholesome about it.
You know, my dad always said the best conversation is conversation you have with yourself. So like, I mean, I feel maybe that could be a real ideal relationship, companionship, you know?
Yeah, it could be. Absolutely. The New York Post article here goes on to say, thankfully, one Japanese company has devised a more tasteful, eco-friendly way to put one's inflatable paramours out to pasture by throwing them a funeral, complete with candles, undertakers, and even mourning mannequins.
Wait, did they do that for the doll they pulled out of the water?
No. This is a Japanese company that's going, hey, don't throw your fucking dolls in the harbor.
Yeah.
Hire us and we'll throw you a doll funeral.
Oh my, well, that's what I mean. I like, that. Could something nefarious be happening? Like, could this be a serial doll killer? Yeah. Or, a homicide.
I don't think that would be called a homicide.
Oh.
It would be mannequin side.
Okay.
A doll or something. Aside? Yeah, doll aside.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway,
very curious. You know who we should send that to? We should send it to our friend Dr. J and see if she can incorporate it into her one of her
get her to write erotic a little stories. Story. Yeah, that's right. all right, let's move right along here. This is very, very fun. So, Brady, you sent this article through Slack. This is actually a CBC article coming from The Nature of Things.
Love our Canadian content.
Love it. These snails have sex for up to 8 hours straight in the Canadian forest. So this is all about snails. I don't know much about snails, but this little article kind of made me appreciate snails on a whole nother level. actually, let's play this video. And this is for listeners at home. You don't need to see the video. You can just hear it. But if you want to see it, go to patreon.com/termion.
Apart from hunger, there's another thing that's driving this little fellow. It wants to look for a mate. Most European snails are hermaphrodites. They're both male and female. This is incredibly convenient, since a snail can literally mate with any other individual it encounters. After they've coupled, both partners are able to lay eggs and produce baby snails.
This music is great.
These two little lovebirds cling together, soul to soul, and move into an upright position. Then they shoot love arrows at each other, loaded with a cocktail of hormones.
That's so aggressive.
The shot needs to hit its mark pretty accurately. The more hormones transferred from one animal to the other, the more eggs are fertilized. Snails aren't particularly faithful to their partners, and any opportunity to couple must be seized.
Oh, slutty snails.
Lovemaking will take snail hours sluts. And hours, but it's a pace that matches the rest of a snail's life.
Look at that thing, the spike.
Yeah, that's... I didn't notice that before.
So, in that video, the thing that you can't see is the love arrows. They're like, they're literally stabbing into and through
the membrane of the snail.
Yeah, it's very aggressive. But the thing that I found so interesting is that so like they said in the video, snails are hermaphrodites. They both have male and female sex organs, which are located on their face.
On their face.
I love the idea of thinking if humans evolved that way, mm-hmm. if we fucked with our faces. Mm-hmm. Because like sometimes when I'm like I am a very much a
passionate kisser.
I like tongue. I like playing with tongues in my mouth. My ideal death is to just die from tongue suffocation. Like that to me is like, all right, cool. I'm down. I'm down to go out that way.
Whoa.
So sometimes when I'm making out, I'm thinking to myself, like, this must look so silly. Like, this just must look... Now I'm like, I look like a snail. I'm just fucking with my face.
Nothing grosses me out more than movie making out.
Sometimes it's nice. Sometimes it's good. So,
well, I mean, yeah, if they get it right. But when they throw in those... Like those kind of sounds?
The sounds, yeah. The sounds coming from those snails, I guarantee you, if you got real close...
What would it sound like?
Oh, fuck yeah.
So much...
Oh, fuck yeah.
Tiny little.
Masters of heavy petting or extreme vetting potential mates will spend up to an hour biting, circling, and touching tentacles. The chemistry has to be just right. So these snails can stay together fucking for up to 8 hours.
I love the idea of that hour of just like their tentacles, like moving around. Cause that's the most interesting part of the snail to me. You know, when you see a snail up close, it doesn't look like much. It looks like a booger in a shell, but it has these two definite little like knobs on the end of little poles out of their head. I always thought they were their eyes, and probably
that's what I thought.
They probably kind of function that way. Like they probably take in information that way, the way that we do with our eyes. But
They do. Snails have eyes on the tips of their tentacles.
Oh, so they're literally. Okay, so they're biting each other's eyes?
In the case of the pulmonates, which are lung breathers, who have two pairs of tentacles, the eyes sit at the tip of the top pair. Even though they have a lens on their eye, they have no muscles to focus the images. How the fuck do we know that? That's insane.
How do we know that?
We know all this shit. But so you can see here in this image here, Bridie, if you Google search, you can see they have the eyes up here. And then they have these little, like, these other little tentacles down on the bottom, which I guess they're part of their sex organs, I guess. Man, snails are crazy.
It blows my mind that they have lungs. What do you mean lung breathers? I mean, of course they do. Yeah. But they look like a clear, like a solidified fat.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. They got lungs. They have a liver. They have kidneys.
Are they heavy drinkers?
They have a stomach.
Wow. Yeah.
They have a vast deferens.
Whoa.
Jesus. Are we part snail?
Yeah. What do we share with the snail?
I've been thinking a lot about, maybe this is for a completely different podcast, but I've been thinking a lot about I've been thinking a lot about aliens lately.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're due for this like.
Visit.
Well, we're due for a visit, but we're not due for a visit. We've been getting visits. But we're due for this sort of disclosure document that's coming out in a couple of days. I think it's like 2 days away.
God, you're gonna have to explain government. It to me.
But anyway, whatever. That's we don't have to get into that. But I've been thinking a lot about this idea of panspermia, and like, which is the notion of. So I think this is debunked, but like there was a theory, and maybe it still is a theory. There was this theory that like octopi, because if you look at octopus on the evolutionary scale or the evolutionary tree, rather, they are their own like unique organism that just like, we can't place what did they evolve from? We don't know. If you're out there and that's wrong, send me an email. I'm a fucking idiot. I don't know anything. But there was, I know, at least a working theory that octopi potentially could have actually become a part of this planet through the means of panspermia, which is this notion that the organism that they derived from came from space.
Right. So on like a meteor or something.
Sure, sure. Like say Venus.
On a rock.
So Venus used to be very much like Earth, right? So let's say like millions and millions and millions of years ago, Venus is not this like hot, gaseous, like hellscape, and is much like Earth. And then this massive comet or whatever hits Venus, and there's all these living organisms on that planet. And that big destructive asteroid blasts a bunch of pieces of Venus into its atmosphere and out past its atmosphere, and then some of those particles get pulled into Earth's gravitational pull and fall to Earth, and there were organisms on those pieces of rock that survived that travel
and became women, right? Because Women are from Venus?
Yeah. Well, this is why I'm thinking about it, because I'm thinking like, you know, anyway, well, we're going down. I got to get off this. Kat Nance is probably listening to this like before her conversation going, what the fuck are they talking about? I'm sorry, Kat.
Go back to the snails.
But I was thinking about like, you know, this whole thing with aliens and there's a lot of discussion about like, you know, maybe they're not from outer space, but maybe they're from interspace. Maybe they've been here all along and they're coming out from the ocean and, you know, yada, yada, whatever. They're drones, whatever. But this thought of like, perhaps maybe humans are a product of panspermia. Like maybe we
came here.
Maybe we ended up arriving here from, you know, some other planetary body. And I don't know. I've been thinking about it a lot lately.
That has crossed my mind a number of times. I don't read as much about aliens and I don't know as much about space as you or anybody. I'm not like everything I've heard or learned about both of those subjects, I've pretty much heard from you. But I remember a long time ago thinking like maybe we destroyed another planet first and then a planet that humans had began evolving on got destroyed and then we ended up here because I just feel like there's this kind of knowing that we have as like beings that it seems to me like we have a knowledge of something that came before this.
Yeah.
And that's always struck me as the case. And when you just said that, when you said that about Venus, I didn't know that Venus used to be different.
Venus used to be like Earth. It used to be like a habitable planet.
Like humans would have been able to survive in that? Like was there oxygen in the atmosphere?
I believe so. Yeah.
Whoa.
That's why Venus is considered like the sister planet to Earth.
Yeah. So when you said that, I was like, oh, Venus is the Eden. Venus is the Eden that we destroyed already, or that a rock destroyed. And I really feel like I think there's probably some sad truth to that.
Well, maybe we'll find out on June 25th.
Please tell me what you find in that. Because
I think it's going to be a big letdown, but
really,
yeah, I think there's some like we got to get off.
They dropped all the interesting stuff.
We
got to
get off this topic because it's a psyops. It's all psyops. It's just something fucking fishy's going on with the government. Anyway, folks, you know what? I do have a quick just the tips.
Yeah, let's do that.
For those of you who are new to the podcast, just the tips is a little segment where Bridie and I give a recommendation to something. And anything doesn't even have to have anything to do with relationships or sex or anything. My just the tips this week, folks, I'm telling you right now, if you are driving and listening to this, pull a U-turn wherever you're going, just stop, pull up into the nearest grocery store, go in there.
Oh my God.
And purchase a bag of Tostitos, hint of lime. Okay. And then go down into the salsa aisle and find any mango or pineapple salsa. Can be either one of those. The combination of fucking hint of lime Tostitos and a fruity based salsa is my crack. I am so addicted. It is such a perfect combination. You don't even need cheese. You know, it's like the most basic chip salsa snack, and it is to die for.
Wow.
Now, if you want to step it up a notch, if you have a very intense hot sauce, take just a little smidgen of that, drop it into the salsa, mix it in, boom. You're living.
Get that guac out of here. We don't need that shit here.
Get the guac out of here. Do you have one?
Yeah. Did I use this one last week? I know I've been like...
I don't think we've done just the tips in a minute.
Okay. Well, I think I've been talking about this show for a long time. There's only like 8 episodes, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Six
no,
or seven I, episodes?
You haven't. You haven't.
I haven't.
No, no.
Okay. If you're driving right now and listening to this, pull a U-turn, go back home, sit on your couch, turn on Netflix, and watch this documentary, Human, The World Within. And like I said, there's several episodes. They've got cool names like React and Pulse and Fuel and Defend and Sense and Birth. And these are all addressing aspects of basically our physiology and biology as human beings.
Yeah, I like that.
And it is like, you know, when they say knowledge is power, that when you, maybe not every minute of every episode will grab you. And maybe you'll have to like, you know, not everyone's a doc person. Maybe you'll have to sit and like, and focus and sort of, and treat it like an assignment, but you are bound to have your mind blown at least once per episode. Just the sheer organization of the body, of the human body, to do all the things that we do. We take it for such granted, and it's fucking magic.
Cool.
It's literally electricity and you know, when you talk about when you're having a really shitty day and you like zoom out and you remember like we're all going to die, it presents a lot of those kinds of moments. More like a, wow, I can't believe how well this thing works. And the things that we've decided to do with it are beside the point. Just the things it's capable of it's just incredible. Anyway, go watch it.
I mean, again, you know, it's not that crazy to think we came from another planet.
Not at all. Especially when we all started as one cell.
Yeah.
Big.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That could travel easily on a rock through space.
Yeah, 100%.
One cell?
All right. Well, this was an interesting little intro. Folks, we hope you enjoy this conversation with Kat Nance because it really was just an absolute treat.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure to follow her on Instagram. Go check out her website. Her website is katnantz.com, KATNANTZ.com. Check out the work that she does because it's very important work. And I think probably pretty useful for a lot of the people that are out there listening right now.
And I feel like I can say this, even though I haven't worked with her, but you're in good hands, I would say, in a good container.
So this is our conversation with Kat Nance. And like always, we will see you on the other side. We are rocking and rolling.
That's how we bow into our
our
Zoom sessions.
That's it.
It's just a clap party. Yeah, that's it. Well, I'm excited to get into today's conversation. I feel like there's a wide array of things that we could potentially get into. Kat, why don't you let's start this entire thing off by giving you the floor to introduce yourself to our listeners and give them a little bit of insight into the work that you do.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited, by the way. So I'm Kat Nance. I'm a somatic sex coach. So most of your listeners will be familiar with the sex coach piece and maybe not the somatic piece.
Mm.
The somatic piece is in the body. Sorry, you realized that it just skipped there. So I hope that's okay. So.
Okay.
The somatic piece is in the body. So my approach is bottom up, working with the fact that 80% of the information our body receives of our neural pathways are in our body going up to our brain. So I work with a lot of folks around sexual trauma and rewriting a lot of patterns that show up in relationships. So I'd say like there's like a very small handful of patterns that show up in relationships. People show up to me and I'm like, I know this pattern. So I'm usually doing a lot of work in that realm. In relationship dynamics.
That's so cool.
Can you be a little more specific about patterns that show up in relationships? Like, what kinds of patterns are we talking about? Like communication breakdown patterns, or like what do you mean when you say that?
Okay, so this is the most common dynamic that I see in couples. Usually the person who identifies as woman shows up to me, feels like something's wrong with them. I have low sex drive. I don't know what's wrong. I just want to figure that out because I feel like it, you know, it's really impacting our relationship. And then what we end up finding out is that's not really the issue. There ends up being a lot of small boundary ruptures within the relationship where the person's body doesn't feel safe opening to sex. So they start to contract. And then there's a lot of things that play into that. The fact that women often don't feel safe saying no. And so then that plays in because they often endure sex. So that's an example. So they show up and we start to explore that and we realize, well, this is work that you actually want to be doing with your partner, because there's this beautiful opportunity to repair there. But we're not used to doing the repair, right? So a lot of couples are sort of like going to their own corners in their own place of feeling hurt by the dynamic of we're not having the sex we want to be having. Often it's like the other partner has more heat in their body. They have more sexual arousal. They're not getting their needs met. The other partner feels like they have to override their needs and they endure through sex. And so a lot, when I'm working with couples anyway, it's often uncoupling this dynamic in their relationship.
Yeah. But I feel like you just described like the first relationship problem that I've run into in every relationship.
I was looking at your screen, Bridie, while Kat was describing that. I was going, I think Bridie's going to say something about this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Sounds familiar.
It's made me really think about what you said, like overriding your needs and, you know, how since I started having sex, like right before I turned 18 and the first year of sex was, well, the first many years of sex was with this one partner that I had. But I remember like distinctly probably a year or so in being like having sex and being like, I don't really want to be here right now. This is not what I want to be doing. And not necessarily feeling like distressed about it, just being like, I guess this is how it is sometimes. So when people come to you and they have these patterns and they're there by themselves, how do you then like turn the mirror to them and be like, well, actually you're going to need your partner to like do this with you?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we start with is doing some repair to the boundary ruptures. So we do a lot of somatic body-based exercises that support people in realizing like, hey, I have boundaries. My first boundary is actually like this line of defense, my skin. And so we work with getting like a really felt sense of their boundaries. And the more that we are in touch with the places that we endure and the places that we override our needs, the less tolerable it becomes, right? So if we're just sort of floating and mostly living in our head and really sort of disassociating during those experiences, like leaving our body and just saying, okay, we'll just wait this out or ride it out or whatever. The goal is to bring people back into their body so that doesn't feel tolerable anymore. And so when that begins to not feel tolerable, then it becomes easier to express your boundaries or understand why the boundaries are actually there, why that state of contraction is happening so often. And contraction is normal, right? Like that's a normal part of our cyclical nature, contraction and expansion. But if we're staying in a state of contraction, then now our body is wired to only look for things that feel threatening or dangerous, right? Like my partner moving their body towards me in a certain way, I'm like, nope, contraction. And so we start associating and overcoupling all of these other pieces in our relationship. And then our body just becomes a no. So we want to like slowly de-thaw those places and let our body know these are not actually threats. So the piece with the bringing the partner in is, I mean, if you have a partner at home who's just going to keep doing the same things that your body is perceiving as a threat, then yeah, your body's going to keep going into contraction because that pattern is so toned, right? And so I really try to frame it like being in relationships, such a beautiful opportunity to heal our wounding. Like we're all wounded. We've all got stuff and nobody escapes their childhood without it. And our relationships, you know, our bodies are compelled to be in relationship with people who are going to help us sort those things out. And so it's not a surprise that we end up in relationship with people who bump up against these dynamics, right?
Yeah.
So why not lean in and say, okay, let's get curious here. Like, what is this for us? What is this dynamic? Can we bring up more curiosity? Because what we often do is we're like, you don't get me. It's like we move into isolation, right? And then we try to have, you know, conversations from a really activated place. And then we think that we're talking here, but really the body's having the conversation. The bodies are the ones that are running the show. And we think it's us, right? Like our cognitive thinking brain. So the somatic piece is like, let's see what the body's saying. Let's get into collaboration with your body here.
Do you ever find yourself do you ever find yourself working with couples where the bumping up against each other has been so constant and has been so grating and has been so like intense on and problematic to the relationship that when it gets to this point where they make the realization with you that like, oh, we need to find this curiosity in order to I'm trying to use the same sort of descriptors that you were using there. I was so engrossed with what you were saying that I completely forgot what you were saying, but, let me take this back. Do you ever find yourself working with couples where they've found such a struggle in the dynamic of their relationship where they're almost to the point where they can't find that curiosity within themselves to do the work? And if so, where do you come in order to try to help them through that? And is that possible?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I work with a lot of people who are at that point because they've sort of waited until things got really bad. And often they've tried a lot of other things. Like they've tried conventional therapy. It like supports them to an extent, right? But the problem is in the body, right? And so we have to go into the body to see what's happening. And often these folks don't have a lot of like somatic intelligence, right? Like that they've been pulled out of their bodies their whole life, like all of us have. Mm-hmm. And if we have a lot of discomfort happening in our body, going back in there doesn't feel that great. And so the approach is often like a slow thaw. So we're looking for other ways outside of the body to create a sense of safety. And even right now, it's like, you know, I'm sitting in my office. I love the color of this couch and I can see it in the video. And then I've got trees. I can see trees around me. So even just like orienting my body to the sense of safety in my room, things that look pleasant and pleasurable to look at. Mm-hmm. So we want to tone their body to be able to notice pleasure again, pleasure opportunities. What are the opportunities of pleasure around you? Like, how can you be letting your body know that it's actually safe? And so if we've spent a lot of time in that pattern, then we've spent a lot of time out of our body, likely, especially as the person enduring. And then the other person is usually closed and shut down, feeling really hard, stonewall,
right?
Because they feel rejected so much. And so they're doing a lot of this. And then the other partner is often like overriding their needs to try and shift things and then also like contracting themselves.
Right.
And so neither of those partners are feeling safe in the relationship. So we want to bring play back in. So we do a lot of games that we would play as a kid, hide and seek, different games to just like for them to have a lot of fun together and to come back into attunement because they're so like over here, right? Like one person's in fight or flight, the other person's in freeze and shut down. And so we want to bring them back and line them back into attunement and have their bodies feel like they can collaborate together again.
Man, I love this. I have, like just anytime we talk about somatic experiencing and getting back to the body, I think a lot about the exercises and like the 4 years of theater school that Jeremy and I did together. And now what you're talking about, this is something I've been thinking about the last couple of days, especially is like the creation of a, what's the word I'm looking for? A creation of a, babe, what's it called when you bring a group of actors together and they work together in a show, an ensemble, ensemble work.
I was going to say a shit show, but yes, an ensemble works too.
So creating how to create an ensemble out of a group of strangers and getting them together and what it is a lot of this like,
a lot of zip, zap, zop.
Well, it's a lot of like move. Yes, exactly. Games, but like moving around each other, like in space together, like where you're doing your own thing, but you're aware of each other. And anyway, all of this like ensemble building is really powerful stuff and the somatic stuff. But when we were in school and doing this work, I remember a lot of emotion and there was no talking about like, by the way, if you have some previous trauma, like this might be, this might fire you up. There, just like, there's none of that. It was just like, you're in it and you're doing it and you're, sometimes you're crying. Sometimes you're like, you're crying so hard. You've got snot running down your face, you know? So what, when it comes to safety and somatic experiencing, that seems like a very, I don't want to say dangerous, but it's a very thin line, I would imagine, that you walk as a therapist when you're guiding people through this work. Like, how do you address trauma when it's, when someone's like, oh, I, you asked me to soften and open up like around my throat, let's say, like I have a lot of tension here and now I'm howling, like help me put the pieces back together. How does this all lead towards me having more pleasure in my life?
Yeah. So first, the theater is you know, a fantastic somatic playground, right? Like the, like it's a really great way to get into your body and to attune to other bodies. And so lots of SE work, somatic experiencing, incorporates some of these like some of that playground, right? It's containment, right? The containment piece, like somatic experiencing, like the biggest piece of our training is containment. Like how do we hold the big things? And I remember one of my, a good friend of mine, an assistant, he said during one of our trainings, and it's a really intense training, right? Because like somebody's poking around in our nervous system who doesn't have any experience doing it. And it's like, you know, it's very upheavaling. Is that a word? Upheavaling?
I mean, I'm with you.
I'm
with
you.
Yeah.
You're with me. You got it. Great. And so, one, it gives us a good map. Hey, this is what it feels like. It's really intense, right? It's a lot to trust somebody with your body. So what he said was presence is the best intervention. And I was like, yes, presence is the best intervention. And so my job as a practitioner is to hold. And I don't know that everybody really gets what that means, but really what it is that I'm the settled body in the room. None of my stuff is coming in. So I'm not merging with my clients. I'm not going into a state of like disappearing and losing a sense of self. So I have a really strong sense of self. I have a strong sense of my boundaries. And with that, I'm able to hold whatever comes up for them. And the other piece is that it's titrated, right? Like SE work is very titrated. And that means we're moving very slowly. We are not going in big to big traumatic memories. And we always have an exit strategy. We always have an exit door. The exit door might be for me, like looking at the trees out my window, but something that orients me back to my space and orients me back into safety and pleasure. And so we always have something that we come back to. So often SE starts off with like us getting like touching into something that feels safe, or the longer that we've done work together, I might be able to say, let's go back into that memory, that favorite memory of you sitting on the beach and seeing like the, you know, the fish moving in the water. And I can bring them back to that moment when things are getting too big. Because a lot of, you know, in the coaching industry, there's a lot of people doing somatic work, but they do it. There's often this really big cathartic component where it's like we do a big purge of trauma.
Right.
And sometimes that can be really great if you're a really well-resourced person. Like I could do it sometimes because I have lots of resources to take care of myself. But actually trauma, because trauma happens so fast, it's often something that's too much, too soon, too big for our body.
Flooding and overloading. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. There's too much flooding. We don't want a flood. So if we think of like a big iceberg, we don't want to melt a big iceberg. No, we want to like slowly thaw it, right? Because there, like you said, there's too much flooding. We don't want flooding because then that's re-traumatization often, right? And so we just want to like touch into it a little bit. And often try to stay as much as we can with the implicit memory, the body memory, instead of going into the explicit of like, here, I'm going to tell you my like most traumatic memory, right? That's what you often do in therapy. That's what I've done in therapy. I go in and I say, here's all my medical trauma. Here's all my developmental trauma. And it's just like, and I can't feel any of it because I'm just speaking it from out. Like my floating head. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just like my body's following the story and I'm getting amped up. And so, you know, SC is really about, let's just pause right there and acknowledge that that was a really big moment for you. Can we just stay with that? And so it's nice and slow.
Yeah.
So with that, then coming back to this piece about the importance of presence and like providing a container for this work, how do you teach that to the couples that eventually will need to provide that for themselves? You know, like, how do you teach a person who is struggling with past trauma and their partner who is contracting because they feel like they're just constantly, you know, slamming against a wall to as a team find that presence with one another and create that container within themselves? Because, you know, I'm guessing this is like, no one in a relationship wants their relationship to just be
what
I was going to say was like, be a relationship that needs to rely on therapy for its own existence forever, you know? So like, where does that come in terms of teaching the patients who are struggling, you know, teaching them the ability to create their own container? Maybe that's a loaded question.
No, it's a really great question, actually. And for me, like, my approach in my work has always been that I want to get people out of my room. Like, how quickly can we resolve something to get you out of the room? And honestly, the structure of therapy is, can we keep you in the room for a very, very long time? Right? It's built to, like, you know, drop little nuggets of support or give you little things. But a lot of people that I've worked with have already tried lots of, you know, standard regular therapy where there's lots of talk, and it moves at a pace that's not actually supportive for their body. It's like, there's not a lot happening there. So I think with SE, well, especially with my approach, is there's a psychoeducation. So we're doing an educational component. So I'm teaching them what I know, like everything that I know about the nervous system and how to support your body and your partner's body. I'm going to teach that to you. And then we're going to go through some exercises so that you can experience those things in your body. And then we're going to spend a lot of time just letting you be in your body without pulling you out of it. And so I think the psychoeducation component is so huge. Like, in my own journey of healing, understanding what's actually happening in my body changed everything for me. I was like, oh, that's why my body does that every time my partner does X, Y, and Z. Or that's why my body does this every time my mom responds to me in this way. And so for me, it actually shifted and changed my relationships across the board in my life. Like, my mom and I weren't even talking. We couldn't even be in the same room. And then I started SE work and everything softened because I could see, oh, this is what's happening somatically. So instead of making up a story about it, right, we feel something in our body and we want to make sense of it. So then in comes the story. And then our fight together is the story. Mm-hmm. Instead of slowing and noticing, hey, your body is like, we're having a really hard time here in our bodies. Like, maybe we can just slow and notice that. So, you know, I think the psychoeducation piece, I think, is probably one of the best, the most helpful components in the work that I'm doing personally. Because I think people, there shouldn't be gatekeepers, I guess is what I'm getting at. I think often in these healing spaces, there's a lot of gatekeeping. Like, I have all the education, I did all the work, and now I'm going to, like, you know, I'm going to, like, therapize you, or I'm going to treat you, but I'm not actually going to give you the information that I know. So my hope, I want everybody to know everything that I know so that they can free themselves, right?
Turn Me On Podcast, we'll be back after this short break.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I actually have a question about shame and somatic experiencing. Because, like I said, Jeremy and I have a lot of these tools. And I was in a professional meeting a couple of days ago with someone I'm hosting a retreat with at the end of August. And she's like this powerhouse. And I have a lot of...
She was my drama teacher.
No. Well, actually a different powerhouse.
Oh, okay.
A different powerhouse.
I thought you were talking
about
Aaron. Sorry.
No. And this woman is also a coach. She's a coach of like high level executives on like leadership and stuff like that. So we're having this conversation and we're preparing our retreat together. And she gets me to stand up and do some exercises because she does this thing called brain gym. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's this really cool way of activating both hemispheres of your brain and like getting, you know, just like grounded and like efficient with your brain power. Anyway, so we did a couple of exercises and I had this moment where I was like, uh-oh, like I'm going to have some emotion here. And it rose up and it expressed myself through crying. And then she was great. She was like, this is the work that I do. And it's like, it makes sense when you cry and blah, blah, blah. But I got off the phone and even though I've done this before, I know this is a really healthy relationship that I have, but for the rest of the day, deep shame of having expressed that in a professional call, even though we were talking about doing this work with other people. So of course it has an effect. But shame is the thing that I was thinking about all day yesterday with regards to this, because I think, you know, I have a lot of shame personally with crying because of how I was told as a kid, like, that's not like, be productive, like tell me what's going on with you. But all I could do is cry. So yeah, like what about those like body feelings that come after when you go home and you're just like, I bared everything and now I don't know how to put it back and like carry on and function.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a few things that I'll say to that. One is that shame is tricky because it's not like our other emotions. It's not like sadness and anger and fear. Those are states that we move through, right? Mm. Shame is like a really heavy blanket that changes our structure, changes the way we move through the world, changes us on a cellular level. And because shame is a cultural thing that we enforce, right? There's healthy shame and there's toxic shame, right? And so often when we're feeling that feeling, like you're saying, you know, afterwards, I just feel this deep shame, that's toxic shame, right? You were told crying, don't cry, like just, you know, tell us what you need. Like, let's be productive here. And you crying isn't productive. And so that's shame, right? And often the thing about shame is that it doesn't actually belong to us. The person carrying the shame isn't the person who's actually supposed to hold it. We're supposed to pass it back to the person who caused the harm. And all of us cause harm at some point. All of us shame somebody at some point. So we're all really meant to be the carriers of our own shame. But the important component of shame is that we're meant to have that ventral vagal after, so that connection and care after. So with something like that, we want to offer our bodies an opportunity to actually renegotiate that trauma, the trauma of, it's not okay for me to cry. It's not okay for me to bear myself in this way. So we want to have you held by people who can tell you, I receive all of you. I'm happy to hold all of you. I'm here. I've got you. And then it just allows you to actually be held in that. And so if you like go from a container where you are being held, but then you go home and it's like, oh shit, that was too much. Was it too much? Does she think that, was she just being nice? Like you're sort of running all through all of that. Right. Mm. So in that situation, I would call like a few friends and I would say, this is what came up for me. Can I just like feel it? No trying to save me, just like witnessing me in that. And then that's like a situation where it was probably too much all at once. Mm. So say for me, if I notice like an intense uprise is happening in your body, depending how long I've worked with somebody or what I'm noticing is coming up, we might slowly bring that energy back down and like orient you to your space or bring you back into something that feels more tolerable or more pleasant so that you're not flooded, right? Because that sounds a bit like you got home and you were flooded and it's like, and now you have to level that out because now your hormones are all over the place. And so now you need, there's like aftercare, right? You need aftercare.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You said you would call a friend and say, don't try to fix anything, but I just need, someone to hold this for me.
Yeah. And to let you know that it's okay to cry and that's how your body discharges. It's actually a really important way to discharge energy. So is yawning. So is like running. So is stretching. I have like a yawn that wants to come on now. So that's just your body discharging energy. It doesn't mean anything about you, right? It's like, good. Your body's doing what it's supposed to do. It's saying there's a lot of energy in your body and it's got to go somewhere. It's out or in. So if it goes in, we become ill in different ways. If it goes out, great. That's good. That's what we want. Energy moving out of our bodies.
Mm. I read this great quote and I don't know where I read it, but it was something about how energy or emotion is energy in motion.
Mm. Yeah.
I love that.
I think that was me. Yeah. I think I said that.
That sounds like something brilliant that you would say.
Kat, I'm curious to know how did you get into this work? Like what was your origin story? What pushed you to do the work that you do now?
Yeah, well, that is a big one. So when I was a kid, so first I was raised by lesbians, so I had a very unique childhood. My family was from Kentucky and my mom moved and had us in Canada. She didn't want to raise us in the US. And then I had a twin brother, he was born with, I think it was 9 holes in his heart. So he ended up having, 3 open heart surgeries, within the first weeks of us being born. So the first I was born and then my mom had to leave and tend to my brother at, sick kids. And we were left with our other parent who was not a great parent. And then also a neighbor. So that's obviously very early attachment wounding. But then the pivotal thing for me was, I was diagnosed with CMT, Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, when I was 4. And then I went on to have 17 surgeries from when I was 10 until I was 16. And so I spent a big chunk of my childhood in the hospital. And so in a lot of pain and a lot of not feeling like my body belonged to me. And I really was a guinea pig. They hadn't done these surgeries. Things kept going wrong and they'd have to go back in and do something else. So it was like, it was a lot of that kind of stuff. And so I actually had my first orgasm while I was in the hospital in a lot of pain, which sparked something like, pleasure and pain go together. And then I started sort of questioning, okay, if my body can be in this much pain, like if I can like be in so much pain that I feel like I'm dying, like surely my body has that amount of capacity for pleasure as well. And so my mom ended up leaving my other parent. She fell in love with somebody else in Waterloo. And so she was like, you know, we're going to Waterloo. You can stay here or you can come with me. I was like, well, I just had a surgery, so I'm going to come with you. And so that shitty parent move, like, come on, mom. And so we moved to Waterloo, but I couldn't get back into school. And so for an entire semester, I was just at home. And so I would meditate every day and do yoga. And I was like, because my doctor had told me, like, this is it. This is the rest of your life. You're just going to manage this level of pain. We can like give like, and at the time they had me on like heavy narcotics, just like, like medication that no child should ever be on for that kind of period of time. So I went off all of the medication and decided to just see if my body could handle it. And I was like, surely if my body's feeling it, it can handle it. And it was true. And so at that time in my life, I realized I could change my relationship to pain and that like pleasure was going to play a big role in that. And so I was just like a big old slut. Like I lost my virginity when I was 13 and I just wanted to have sex all the time. And like, for me, it wasn't filling a hole. It was like this, it really was for me, this like deep exploration of this other piece of myself. This, you know, sex for me was where I got to meet myself in ways that I couldn't otherwise. And so, yeah, it was really amazing that I got, you know, something to learn that at such a young age. So that sparked it for me. And then I became the friend that, you know, everyone came to talk about sex and, you know, I've never had an orgasm. Okay, let's talk about how we can make that happen. And so I became that friend. And then when I was in my early 20s, my partner was like, you should just start coaching people. I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, you should run a workshop. Cause I was trying to like raise money to go to this other event. And he's like, yeah, just run a workshop and see how it goes. And that's how it started. And then the SE piece came in because a lot of my work was already body-based. We were already doing that because that's what I had learned in my own body already. But I was seeing like, hey, we're really touching on some things here. And I don't think I actually have like the tools. Like I think I should be more educated around what I'm holding. And so then that's when I started that like SE training so that I knew what's happening in the body and how to support people properly.
How much it, like within that journey and realizing that like you wanted to deepen your education, how much of the SE work, how important was the SE work for you personally in terms of like working through what sounds like a pretty traumatic childhood?
Yeah. Well, first I'll say I'm really, really resilient. I think like some people have a level of resilience online that's like, you know, I had like a, you know, I know they say like if you have one person who believes in you and is supporting you, and for me that was my Aunt Lynn. And I was always really resilient, so it never, like I never felt really traumatized by all of those things. But what SE did was it helped me unthaw. Like as an example, like in my SE training, you sometimes the teacher will do like examples of sessions. And so then somebody in the class will be the person, like the client or the lender is what we call it. And so, like I did a lending session with anesthetic with my SE teacher. And it's really fascinating because when you call, so some of my anesthetic is around, or some of my trauma is around like anesthetic, right? General anesthetic, but not local. Mm. So what we learn in SE is that you want local anesthetic as well, or at least, right? Because local anesthetic means that the area is being numbed. So the body remembers, right? So even though I'm being put under, I still have this sense, like, I'll try not to get too graphic into it, but like I can, like if I pull up that memory, like I can get a sense of it now, I can feel them like rooting around in my leg, which is where I had the surgeries. So even though I can't like explicitly pull up the memory because I was, you know, knocked out, I can feel it. I can feel it somatically and implicitly in my body. And so SE work helps us unwind those things. So there's these trauma patterns that show up that we might not even be aware of. So say for me, I get chronic migraines, like, you know, I would not be surprised if that's connected to like this medical trauma, or, you know, I get like hypersensitivity to smell. Again, those things are connected. So SE work gave me the tools to actually like come back into my body and to be able to feel parts of my body that I hadn't felt in a long time. So my, you know, my left leg has been numb since I was a kid, and that's like nerve damage. But really what it is the numbness was a way for my body to protect me from having to feel what was happening there. And so now I'm starting to slowly unthaw that numbing and get more sensation back. So it's big, like the SE work is just like there. I honestly, there's nothing like it. It's wow. Like, it's so huge. Yeah. I've never, yeah. And all the therapies I've done and anything I've ever done, SE work has been the only thing that's ever been able to unwind the trauma patterns in my body.
Can you give us an example? So that's a physical, very physical trauma. Can you give us an example of like, you know what? I'll tell you, today it's been 19 years since my sister died in a car accident. And that was the first, I'm sure there were lots of little micro traumas in my childhood. I was 18 years old when she passed away. So my entire worldview changed. Like I was on the precipice of like graduating from high school, going out and like self-actualizing. And this death happened. And you know, when I look back, this is 19 years ago, I look at my body and I go, I have an entirely new body. I don't have an 18-year-old body anymore. That is so far behind me. Now I'm 37, but I can still feel that something changed in me physically 19 years ago that I still live with. And I put my hands around my heart because that's where I feel it. But how, like, as a client of yours, let's say, I can understand, like, you know, a physical injury that has created a barrier between me and my partner now, because that, like, that I can directly understand. But the emotional trauma, or the trauma that's like just in there somewhere around my heart muscle. Like how do you dress? What do you do? How do you coach someone through SE with sort of a floating ambiguous pain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, first I'll say physical trauma, emotional trauma, it's all going to have correlating symptoms, right? Your emotional trauma does have physical symptoms. You feel it in your chest. You know, you're saying like, you know, I feel it here, or, and then you're calling it this floating ambiguous, like pain or however you said it. And so we would go into here, right? Because there still is pain there. And then for me, like my physical trauma, my medical trauma is very emotional too, because what was missing, so I had, you know, 17 surgeries and then like hundreds of like other medical procedures. They weren't all traumatizing. Traumatic, but they weren't traumatizing. So some of them were traumatizing. And so we're looking at what was missing. So your sister passing away, that's such a shock to the system. At a point in your life where you're expanding and opening and seeing possibility, you would have contracted, right? Everything would have just like come in like that. And it's too much losing the loss of somebody. It's like, it's so deeply painful. And when it's a surprise like that, our body it's too much. And so it needs years to heal from that. And that's, we know, like in the first year of trauma or after the loss of somebody, it's just like you're floating through life. You can't really feel anything. You're not really necessarily touching into the body because it's too much for that trauma really slowly. And so it would be treated the same way that like medical trauma would be treated or anything else. We would just go into the body and honor what's happening. What are you feeling? How are you feeling that? Like, how do you notice that ambiguous floating in your body? Where does it live? What does it feel like? What is the texture? What is the quality? And then we would probably work with time stamping it. This feeling belongs back in that moment where you lost your sister and you got the news, right? So it belongs back in that moment. So when you feel the flooding of it now, we want to start distinguishing between the difference, what belongs in that memory back in that moment, and what do you actually feel that belongs to this moment right now in the present. And so we want to start distinguishing so we can, like, you know, give it back to that moment, basically. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's so, I have to think about that for a while, because I often feel like the feeling is meaningful and important and telling me something about how to live now. And like, I like honoring it is, I really love that you say that, because it was the physical sensations or the contraction, I guess, was really important at the time to protect. But I, you know, I think that the experiencing, I guess just for the average person to know, to feel the difference in different parts of their bodies between expanding and contracting is, I don't know. I'm kind of blown away by what you're saying, because I just think it's such a gift to people. And when, you know, I go in to teach a yoga class and I want to be aware of like being trauma informed, I'm not trauma informed trained. But like so many things you've said have really resonated in terms of like creating a container and holding the space for people and being an anchor, being the settled body in the room. But I want to give people what you're talking about, mm-hmm. which is just like, get in there and like feel what you're feeling. I don't have the training you have, so I gotta be way more responsible than that. Mm. But can you tell us a little bit about what the training of Essie was like? And you told us a little bit, but like, how long is the training? What are the pillars? What do they make sure that you go home with at the end of the day?
Well, it's a lot. It's really intense. So it's 3 years. The training is 3 years. You can speed it up so the trainings, they're usually like, it's 4 to 6 days long. And then there's like 3 months in between. You have to do your practice sessions with a registered practitioner, like somebody who's registered with SE. And then you have to do your personal sessions. So not practice sessions, but consult sessions. Sorry. So consult sessions with another SE practitioner. And then you have to do your personal sessions with an SE practitioner, and then group sessions. So that's all happening in between the trainings. And then the trainings are, you know, it's just, they really blow my mind, because it's just 4 days of being in your body. Mm. And honestly, I never suggest anybody to be in their body that long. That's too much, because we don't live in a world that actually really supports us being in our bodies. Our world is too fast. When you look at capitalism and everything that's happening, there's too much pressure on us to perform and get things done, that if we were in our bodies all the, sorry about that. If we were in our bodies the whole time, it would be flooding too much. It takes a lot of work to be in our bodies all the time. So most of the training is doing practice sessions with three other people. So you have somebody who is lending their nervous system, somebody who's practicing, and somebody who's observing. And then you have an assistant in watching you do that. And so you take a turn being each one of those. And so it's intense, because one, you're practicing in front of a group of people, which like I'm never practicing, you know, I mean, when I do courses and workshops and stuff, sure, but it's not practicing, you know, I'm not. So, and then you're letting somebody go into your nervous system and poke around, which is really intense. I definitely have done some practice sessions where I was like, man, that was fucked. Yeah. It's just like, yeah. so intense. So now I'm way more like I feel into like the people in the space, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I don't want to practice today. Like I do not want you poking around in my nervous system. So I had a couple, and people are practicing, and so they're, you know, they're doing their best, and that's the point. But I remember I did a practice session and a friend of mine who I met through SE, my friend Evan, he's an assistant in the course. And so he was assisting in that. And this trauma came up, because we went into drowning. So drowning and choking, poisoning, anesthetic, those sorts of things. So we go into like really heavy topics, like medical trauma. Like we're going into these topics, talking about what's happening in the body when those things happen. And then we go in and we touch on any of our trauma that's connected to that. So for me, it's like every training, I'm like, here we go. So we were doing this. I'll read. I'm like, fuck. I'm like, I don't want to. So we were doing this one where I almost, I was sharing where I almost drowned. And it was, and I, even right now I can get like a sense in my body. So I'm noticing like my body, like my throat feels like it's contracting. I feel a bit like dizzy. So this is like distinguishing it, like noticing what's actually happening in the body for one, as we're telling the story is really important, because often we just tell the story and we don't notice what's happening somatically. So in that, so that my a friend who's the assistant, he had to like step in and be like, hey, I'm here. So I was like, I feel like I'm drowning. I think I'm drowning right now. Like in the, I was drowning. And so this is why you want to be really mindful. Like we don't just like I would never in a session with my clients, just jump into their trauma. Like, because your body will bring you right back to that moment. Because that's a smart way of surviving the future, right? Like right. It needs to know, like, what did we do to survive then? We need to pull up those resources now. Mm. So, yeah, back to the SE training. It's really intensive. It's, it's a beautiful container because there's, yeah, go ahead.
It sounds like it's important that it's so intensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
most certainly.
Yeah. It's, yeah, definitely the most intensive thing I've done, and healing. Like I've gotten so much healing just from doing the training itself. Yeah. And yeah, it's really powerful. I just want everybody to do it. You know, I want everybody to do the training, like every, like layman's people, everybody, just because, you know, we all deserve to have that, this access. And it's not the same as reading a book, because I've read all of the trauma books, you name it. I've probably read it. It's not the same as feeling it in your body. So we've got all the information up here. Jeremy, you were sort of, you know, touching on this earlier, like I know all the things. I know all the things. I'm very smart. I know all the things. But why is that not landing here? Because 80% of our neural pathways, of the information that our body and our mind are picking up on, is bottom up, from the body up. And we do most of our processing, most of our learning cognitively.
Right.
In that 20%, we're doing like 90%, where really we should only be doing 20% of the work. And so when we go and incorporate the body and bring the body back in, and this piece, it's like the mind and the body together, then we actually get to do like the real processing.
That's where it connects. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Kat, I got to say, this has been really eye-opening and a really, really lovely conversation. I would love for you to just share with our listeners, like where can people find you? Where can people stay up to date with the work that you're doing?
Yeah. So you can find me anywhere just under my name, Kat Nance. So my website is katnance.com. I'm on Instagram as Kat Nance and Facebook as Kat Nance. I run long form workshops. So I do a couples workshop, and then I do a course called Rewilding Pleasure. And I'm going to be offering a boundaries workshop soon. And I do lots of one-on-one work. I have spaces opening up in July. So for anybody wanting to do any one-on-one work, that's how you can find me.
Amazing.
We will spread the word loud and far.
We certainly will. And that's Kat Nance, NANTZ. Or Z, depending on your formal education. Kat, I want to say thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your day today to sit down and chat with us. This really, really was great.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
There we go, folks. That was our conversation with Kat Nance. Hope you enjoyed that. Thank you all so much for tuning in, wherever you are tuning in from, whether that be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, any of that shit. If you are listening from Apple Podcasts, we would love if you left a little rating and a review, because it keeps us up on the charts there. And if you're on Spotify, make sure you have hit the follow button, because that also is very helpful for us. So if that's one way you want to support the podcast, we appreciate that. But there's also another way you can support the podcast, which you probably heard in the middle of this episode during the commercial break. Brady, why don't you let the folks know how they can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. More than ever, we could use your financial support if you're in a position to do so on Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/turnmeon. And we've got some really cool Patreon exclusive merch. We're going to be doing, you've already heard, some cool behind the scenes stuff of a making of season 3. And you'll just be able to rest easier at night knowing that you are supporting a couple of artists stumbling through the podcasting and world journey to bring you content that we hope that you find really entertaining. And we'd be ever so grateful if you would show us that with your hard-earned money.
That's right. And actually, one of the new tiers on our Patreon, for anyone who joins, you get to be added to our personal close friends list on Instagram. And already had some people added there on mine. Very excited. Thanks and welcome.
Yes, we did have some new patrons sign on this week. We'll give you a personal shout out by name shortly. But I just
by name and address. We will dox you next week. Get ready for that.
Get ready for the mail.
All right, folks. We love you. Thank you so much for listening. That is it for this week. Until next week.
Why don't you go touch yourself?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.